The body is not that sensitive. We were meant to be stressed and to be resilient in the face of that. And so I see all of this stuff again, the internet boogeyman of cortisol. Our body can handle these increases in cortisol temporarily, and that doesn't necessarily translate to poor outcomes. And in fact, we can see that translate to better outcomes by way of our muscle mass and performance, or even just our ability to be resilient in the face of day-to-day stress.
Hello and welcome to the Consistency Project Podcast. My name is Patrick Cummings. As always, I'm here with E.C. Sinkowski. Every week on the show, we aim to simplify the science of nutrition, health, and fitness, cutting through the noise to focus on the principles and practices that'll help you perform better, feel better, and live better. Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week. Hello, EC. How the heck are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm great. This week, we are going to talk through some of the misconceptions around cortisol and the so-called stress hormone and its relation to weight gain, high-intensity workouts, and fasting. We'll get into how stress can actually lead to improved body composition and resilience, challenging the widespread belief that stress is always detrimental to our health. We're going to get into that in just a second, but first we want to make sure folks know about the Three Pillars Method Masterclass. You hear us talking about it often. You've heard us talk about it a lot recently, but one thing we want to make sure you know about is if you are a coach and you would like to affiliate with EC and the Three Pillars Method Masterclass, now is the time to do it. Sign up before April 17th, jump into the 10-week nutrition masterclass that EC has been perfecting for years and learn all the tips and tricks to how to get your clients through the 800-gram challenge, lazy macros, and everything else they need to own their diet finally, and so they can stop going ping-ponging back and forth. Ping-ponging. Nobody likes to ping-pong back and forth. All right, my friend. Cortisol. Cortisol. Let's do a little bit, maybe background information on what that even is, in case folks don't know.
It's definitely one of the internet boogeymen.
Of the many.
Yeah, definitely. And we've talked about it a little bit before in the Stress Eating Podcast, which actually we'll have to come back to a little bit today, but specifically wanted to tackle those topics that you already teased around cortisol. And I hear that all the time, that this belief is out there that cortisol and stress is the reason that they have the weight gain, or is the reason that they're not seeing their body composition shifts. And oftentimes too, it happens to do again with specifically gaining weight around the midsection or belly fat or something like that. So this whole podcast is going to try to tackle that from beyond just the stress eating approach, but understand what cortisol is and is not doing related to those goals many people have.
All right, so let's do maybe a little bit of background information on cortisol. What do we need to understand about it to understand what we're going to talk about going forward?
Yeah. So you kind of mentioned already, it is known as the stress hormone, although it does have a lot of other functions in the body. We're not really going to touch on those here because it's unrelated to the topics that we've kind of teased already. But it is a glucocorticoid, which is a type of steroid hormone, which really just refers to its chemical structure. And it does play a central role in protein, fat, and carbohydrate metabolism in the body. Now, glucocorticoid receptors are present in almost all of the tissues. So cortisol has the ability to affect a ton of different organ systems, from the immune system to the cardiovascular system to the nervous system, muscular skeletal, etc. Now, in terms of the stress response, cortisol is actually a longer acting hormone. So when we think about fight or flight responses, that typically is not from cortisol. That's more from the catecholamines like epinephrine, aka adrenaline. It's when the threat remains, cortisol is released from the adrenal glands to help the body stay alert and responsive for a longer period of time. You know, part of this longer term response under stress, we're going to need to have energy present. We're going to need to have energy present to it. Maintain that high alert state. Our brain sucks up a ton of glucose. And we're also going to need a lot of energy around so that if we have to run or sprint or fight or something like that. So we need to make sure that we have a lot of energy present. And so it's really useful, in my opinion, to think about cortisol is as a mobilization hormone. It's helping to mobilize your existing energy stores from the liver, the muscle, or the fat. And so it's your liver and your muscle cells where we store energy as glycogen. That's just long chains of glucose molecules strung together. And an increase in cortisol will result in the breakdown of that glycogen so that you can have these glucose molecules that will be used for immediate energy. Cortisol also promotes a process called gluconeogenesis in the liver. This is the process of creating more glucose from non-carb sources like amino acids. And then cortisol will also help break down the fat in the fat cells into the smaller constituent pieces of the fatty acids and the glycerol molecules, which again can be used as energy. Now, cortisol can also break down muscle to be used for energy, but we're going to dig into how relevant that is for you, because I know people get quite fearful when they hear that. But it's useful for now to think about cortisol as almost the opposite to insulin. So insulin is trying to put away nutrients and store them, and cortisol is trying to mobilize them, increasing blood sugar and making more nutrients available for energy. Now, of course, while cortisol is essential, we do have problems if somebody has too much or too little. Cushing syndrome is when people have too much cortisol for a long period of time, or hypercortisolism. And a common symptom of that is actually weight gain. And so this is some of the fear that people have, too much cortisol and weight gain. But generally, Cushing syndrome or too high cortisol is the result of somebody having a tumor on their pituitary gland. And at the other end of the spectrum, we have Addison's disease, which is too little cortisol. And this is most commonly caused by an autoimmune disease on the adrenal glands. And I like to point those out because both of those are diagnosable conditions with, you know, diagnostic standards, and they're not the result of, let's say, being, you know, quote, stressed out in day-to-day life.
Got it. Okay. You've mentioned a few times the maybe the purported relationship between cortisol and weight gain, but what is the actual relationship between those two things?
Yeah. So this is where we kind of talked a little bit about it in the stress eating podcast, but some people respond to stress by stress eating, and that is influenced by many things besides just being stressed. It's the type of stress. If it's catastrophic stress or let's say acute stress versus let's say this chronic day-to-day stress that I think people feel a lot in our modern busy lives. It's also influenced by the environment, what's around you, what types of foods are around you. And this isn't something that we necessarily touched on directly in the stress eating podcast, but it's also influenced by the individual's own coping mechanisms, you know, what's kind of their emotional regulation state. You know, like I mentioned, I think a lot of us in our modern busy lives with all of our different to-do lists, we're typically dealing with this kind of day-to-day chronic stress, moderate level stress. And in our modern food environment, it also then is filled with all of this accessibility to our calorically dense foods. And when we have cortisol, this can make people turn to those comfort foods because they're going to give us that dopamine release that will help kind of counteract that stressful feeling. And it turns out that women are more likely to use these hyperpalatable, calorically dense foods to cope. Men actually, you know, this is on average, of course, tend to turn more towards alcohol or nicotine. And we do see that there's this association, not causation, association between stress eating and obesity, and that association is stronger for women than men. Layered on top of this is also the fact that people who have weight to lose can sometimes be stressed out about the fact that they have weight to lose. So sometimes this can kind of create this kind of continuous cycle of using the food to cope with the stress, which is also leading then to the weight gain. And so, of course, we've talked about the strategies about keeping your environment clear. And then this is also where, you know, mindful eating comes into play. Paying attention to hunger and satiety cues and trying to understand, okay, what are my coping mechanisms that I have to deal with stress? And so I wanted to highlight this study by Her House in the show show notes, and it's cool because it shows how weight outcomes can be really variable, and it's not necessarily the stress itself. It's kind of our response to the stress. And so what this study did is it took 36 obese men and women, and it also took 36 healthy weight men and women, and it categorized them as low or high in terms of their cortisol reactivity in response to stress. So how much cortisol was released from a stress test? And the stress test was something like they had to study and take an interview, and then they had to do some calculation or something. So some type of stressful scenario. And after that test, they were allowed to eat. But during that time that they were allowed to eat, they were told, okay, you're going to be tested again. So the idea was they wanted these people to have still stress on the mind. And so they then were able to see, okay, how much cortisol are these people release, and we're able to say, okay, these people have a lot of cortisol and these people not so much. Now, what happened to how much food they ate? Well, for the healthy weight individuals, there was no difference in the amount that was consumed, whether or not they had a lot of cortisol released or a lower level of cortisol released. The point being, some people have a high cortisol release, but they don't necessarily gain weight from that. And that's because they've developed their own coping strategies for the stress. It's this their own emotional regulation of maybe it's breathing, maybe it's just recentering, mm-hmm. maybe it's talking to yourself. There can be all different types of coping strategies. And then within the obese weight individuals, the high cortisol reactivity individuals were the ones who ate significantly more. And so part of the driver then potentially for their obesity is the fact that they are now using eating as their coping mechanism for stress instead of some other alternatives. Now, I'm not trying to say that I think it's easy for people to change from stress eating. But what I want to try to point out with something like this is it's not a foregone conclusion that just because I am stressed or just because I have cortisol released that now I am gaining weight. Right? Mm-hmm. There are some people who stress eat, and while they could also develop a more emotional, healthy response to it, some people also don't necessarily gain weight from that because they just don't get into a caloric surplus. They could necessarily stress eat, and then later that day they don't eat as much, or they kind of don't eat as much the next day. And mm-hmm. so for stress eating to result in weight gain, we need to have a surplus of calories to do that. And it's not a foregone conclusion that, you know, I'm stressed out and therefore I'm gaining weight.
Got it. Okay. So I think I got it on the stress eating and the weight gain, the relationship there.
Yeah.
Can you then explain, or kind of moving on from that, can you explain what the concerns are about high intensity exercise, cortisol, and weight gain? Because those are the kind of the two things we teased here, stress and whether it's CrossFit or other high intensity training. What does that look like?
Yeah. So just to get a sense of what's out there and what people are hearing about stress and high intensity exercise, this was just a quick Google search about it. Quote, there appears to be mounting evidence that HIIT or HIIT style training causes a chronic increase in cortisol. Cortisol is commonly known as the stress hormone. It's associated with poor sleep, belly fat, and stress and anxiety, end quote. So when they say HIIT, they're of course referring to high intensity interval training, similar to CrossFit, functional fitness stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the parts that are true. Yes, exercise does make cortisol go up because it's that mobilization hormone, right? If we need energy mm-hmm. to work out, it makes sense that cortisol would increase to be able to supply our muscles to have the energy to sprint and lift and jump and whatever. So of course, cortisol should go up. And we just talked about the fact of how cortisol is related to weight gain in the sense of we still need that caloric surplus to drive the actual weight gain. Now, here's the nuance. Cortisol may affect the distribution of fat on somebody's body. So yes, the calories have to be consumed to a level that is in excess of the person's need to gain the weight. But high levels of cortisol can result in that excess weight being more centralized to the abdomen. And so this is what's actually happening to those people who I said have Cushing's syndrome, chronically high level of cortisol. They gain weight primarily around their midsection. The weight still comes from the high, excess consumption of calories, but the distribution is because of the high cortisol levels. And so that sort of sounds like I'm agreeing with that initial quote I took from the web. But what's wrong about that quote is when they say HIIT training or high intensity training causes a chronic increase in cortisol. No, no, hard no there. Exercise causes an acute or short-term increase in cortisol. It peaks around 60 minutes after an exhaustive effort, in fact, but is not stuck high like somebody who has Cushing's syndrome. It goes up and back down, just like your heart rate goes up and back down. Your respiratory rate mm-hmm. goes up and back down. Your inflammation levels even go up and back down in response to exercise. So this is another perfect example of how we can't take a short-term view of something and try to extrapolate it to a long-term effect. And so to confirm this, we just need to go to the research and look at, hey, what's the effect of high-intensity training on fat mass? And lo and behold, we have the Mallard study in the show notes. It's a meta-analysis. We love those. 39 different studies. Quote, HIIT significantly reduced total abdomen and visceral fat with no differences between the sexes. Mm. Continuing, HIIT is a time-efficient strategy to decrease fat mass deposits, including those of abdominal and visceral fat mass, end quote. So here we have people who are actually doing high intensity training and they're finding that their body composition improves, and even it improves talking about the fat around their midsection. And so it's just crazy to me, in a world where we have 53% of people who aren't meeting their aerobic guidelines, 76% of people aren't meeting also the strength guidelines according to the CDC, and we have people on the internet telling people to stop doing HIIT or high intensity training. It's like all forms of exercise should be encouraged. Most everybody needs to exercise more. And in my opinion, HIIT can be a great way for people to improve their aerobic and their strength conditioning outcomes.
Okay, so we tackled stress. We talked a little bit about HIIT. I think the third thing we teased up at the front was fasting. So is this the same, what we just talked about with HIIT, is that the same general concern as it relates to fasting, in that it promotes higher cortisol and therefore theoretically weight gain or fat gain?
Yep, it is. I do think there's also this concern, I teased a little bit, about muscle protein breakdown affecting body composition. Let's first touch on that fat gain piece. This is from a direct quote from a very popular book. People ask me about this expert all the time. Quote, and it's designed more towards women, but quote, please, please don't do intermittent fasting. Fasting drives cortisol up, creating an elevated baseline of cortisol, which promotes fat storage, end quote. This type of sentence really bothers me because, again, it promotes this idea of like spontaneous weight gain. And anytime I see stuff like that, I just keep thinking that these people need to travel to some less developed and less affluent areas of the world and look at the effects of not eating. You know, it's not weight gain. It's not spontaneous weight gain at all. The body cannot create fat out of nothing. You know, fat cells hold molecules that are carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen molecules stuck together. And where do we get those? We get those from the macronutrients that we've consumed above and beyond our needs that we haven't needed yet for energy. So we have to have like consumed those molecules first for the fat to appear anywhere on our body. Now, fasting, like exercise, increases acute levels of cortisol, no surprise, to mobilize energy, to get us that period of fasting. So we have these acute elevations in fasting, but it's not chronic. You know, your 16-hour fast doesn't send you into hypercortisolism. You know, your 16-hour fast isn't going to redistribute all the fat on your body to your midsection. They're just these short, acute changes, not long-lasting effects. And so again, instead of thinking about, okay, what's going on with cortisol and what's happening in this minute to my cortisol levels, we have to think, okay, let's look at papers of people who are fasting. What happens to them, right? And so there's this Gu paper in the show notes from 2022. Again, a meta-analysis. We're talking of a randomized controlled trials. We love that. They were comparing intermittent fasting to just caloric restriction, or if the people went on no diet at all. So we had kind of three different variables there. Did they fasting? Are they counting calories? Or are they just doing their same old diet? Included 43 randomized controlled trials, and basically they found that intermittent fasting could reduce body weight, waist circumference, and fat mass without affecting lean mass compared to individuals who did not change their diet at all. And they did show that intermittent fasting had less of a benefit than caloric restriction, which of course should make sense to our audience because they understand that when we're fasting, we might not be as precise as when we're actually counting the calories that we're consuming. Now, this is what's also cool about this study. They did also break down the studies looking at the effects of fasting on men versus women. And guess what? Fasting still had the ability to reduce fat mass in women. So we don't have a ton of evidence that fasting is promoting fat gain. And I also wanted to take another look at a paper because I also hear some concerns about fasting and aging. And so this is the Damaszewski, I guess, paper in the show notes from 2020. They were looking at body composition of women over 60 years old. So they had 45 women over 60 years old, 6-week program where they were doing 16-hour fasts. And guess what? They lost about 2 kilos of fat mass and, quote, the skeletal muscle mass did not change significantly, end quote. One more, I think, on studies here I wanted to highlight. It's the Battitucci paper in the show notes, but this was a single study. They were looking at HIIT training and body composition for women with obesity. And they also had a combination where those women were doing HIIT training and they had some of them fast. So now we've got the double whammy, Patrick, here of high intensity training and fasting, right? Oh my God.
The internet is shaking its head.
So much stress is going on, right? There was a reduction of body fat loss and an increase in the fat-free mass or lean mass in the fasting and exercise group. So here, the group that's, quote, so stressed out, they're doing all this fasting and they're doing this high intensity training. Oh my gosh, so much cortisol. Wow, we end up with better body composition, less fat mass, more lean mass. So maybe, maybe we don't need to be worried about these short-term cortisol changes. And I just want to point out, like, with these studies on fasting, I haven't changed my mind that I think fasting is all of a sudden this superior, you know, amazing diet and something like that. The results are really still coming down to the fact that the people were cutting calories. But the point is, if fasting was enough of a stress to drive weight gain, where is it? where is it when we look at the randomized control trials? Where is the weight gain when we look at high interval, high intensity interval training? It's not there. So we find that cortisol can go up temporarily, but this doesn't necessarily translate to weight gain or body composition, poor body composition shifts.
Kind of mentioned that last study, the fasting group didn't just have fat loss, but maybe even had some muscle mass gain. Since everybody listening to this wants to get huge and swole, can you talk about any specific cortisol issues as it relates to muscle mass?
Yeah. And I mentioned this in the beginning that cortisol, being the mobilization hormone, can in fact mobilize energy from muscle. So it can break down your muscle to create energy from basically the protein or the amino acids in your muscles to keep the body running. The nuance here, though, is the body is not going to your muscles first for energy. It's not the first line of defense. In fact, it's going to take about 24 hours to tap your liver glycogen before the energy supply will then have to shift more to maybe protein and even fat stores, of course. Even still, this doesn't mean that at 24 hours, all of a sudden, all you do is use muscle. But still, the point is, like, we have 24 hours and still we really start getting into our protein stores. And so I would not suggest 24-hour fasts for those looking to maximize their muscle mass, because at some point your body is going to start using some muscle to fuel itself. And the chances of that happening increase the longer you go without food. But I mean, sometimes I'm like, isn't this obvious? Like, don't skip eating for days.
If you want to get huge.
Like, if you want to get huge, let's not skip eating for days. I mean, this to me is like, then sometimes I think we start giving all these recommendations that are just so obvious. It's like, well, make sure you eat every day. It's like, okay, got it, you know? And so this is, you know, we talked about this in our fasting episode, but we do have, I quoted some already, but again, in that episode, numerous intermittent fasting studies or time-restricted feeding studies where we don't necessarily see a decrease in lean mass. It's not long enough when people are doing these 16-hour overnight fast, even a little bit longer, 18-hour. It's not necessarily long enough and creating enough of a caloric deficit that all of a sudden we have all of this muscle mass just stripped off the body. Now, I will also say regarding muscle mass, some people are concerned not necessarily about the fasting length of time, but their workout sessions might be too long in the sense of, let's say I do an hour plus workout. Maybe now that's becoming too catabolic. Maybe that's the stress of the workout session is starting to break down the muscle mass. And this is a really cool study. It's an older study by West in the show notes. They actually found that higher cortisol levels measured mid-workout in like a resistance training effort correlated with an increase in lean body mass. Now, this sounds counterintuitive because cortisol, if we're thinking about mobilization and does have the ability to break down muscle, and how I'm saying that these higher cortisol levels correlated to an increase in lean body mass. The reason that occurred is because basically it means that the people that were working harder during their resistance training sessions, ultimately it predicted a greater adaptation of more muscle later down the line. So that pushing yourself in a workout, putting a more stress on yourself during the workout ended up to being a better adaptation in terms of muscle mass growth. No surprise there, right? Now, this study was done on men. I could already hear the critics, but I'm willing to bet we're going to see the same thing in women, that if you want to grow more muscle mass, that yeah, you're going to work hard in your workout session. And yes, your cortisol will be high and that is okay. And I kind of want to just put a bow tie on all of this stuff because I just love this study by, I think it's Ramel in 2007. they were looking at cortisol response and heart rate response to another psychosocial stress, another one of these stress tests where, you know, again, they're going to quiz the people, they're going to give them a math problem to solve and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, what they were doing is they were looking at the difference in the stress response, the heart rate response from what they call elite sportsmen, as well as healthy but untrained men. The trained men, the elite sportsmen, had less of a cortisol response and a lower heart rate response to the stress test than the untrained men. Not, in my opinion, not too big of a surprise, right? Because it's like, okay, yes, the elite sportsmen who are working hard day in and day out, putting themselves into stressful situations, are more adapted to the stress through their training than the untrained men. And so I think what I'm really trying to say with that is, like, the body is not that sensitive. We were meant to be stressed and to be resilient in the face of that. And so I see all of this stuff, again, the internet boogeyman of cortisol, that, like, yes, our body can handle these increases in cortisol temporarily, and that doesn't necessarily translate to poor outcomes. And in fact, we can see that translate to better outcomes by way of our muscle mass and performance, or even just our ability to be resilient in the face of day-to-day stress.
Take it. I think the only one follow-up question, or the thing I kept thinking about as we went through that, is, you know, whether it's cortisol, or as you mentioned, the stress episode we've done, or even the episode on aging, or episodes on aging.
Yeah.
There seems to be a lot of things people want to point to as this is the reason why it happens. Mm. And a lot of times what we talk about is, no, it's what you're doing, whether it's in the kitchen or what you're not doing, you're not active, whatever. And it just strikes me that people want to find, call it the boogeyman or not, but they just kind of want to find the excuse that kind of abdicates their own responsibility of, like, what am I doing that causes these things? No, I don't want to think about that. That's not it. It's this chemical or this hormone or this reality of being an older person. I don't know. I don't really even have a question. It's just, it, as we have these conversations, the themes keep coming back to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it is really interesting to look and see what's under the hood. And again, mm-hmm. you know, having high cortisol can result in something like stress eating. And once you have that pairing, I think we're going to talk about that soon, that's a hard habit to break. So I don't want to say that all of this stuff is so easy, but I do find that when we start looking under the hood, that we start to just try to look at, let's say I'm not a car person. We only look at the gas tank and we're like, okay, turns out the car needs way more than a gas tank to run, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we have a lot of moving parts and pieces, and you are so zeroed in on the gas, and this has nothing to do with that. This has something to do with the brakes or the steering or something like that. So I think it's just important for people that, like, once we start looking under the hood, you probably are a little bit limited to all of the influences that are coming into this picture. Yeah.
I love that you just went, like, right into a car metaphor, knowing you knew nothing about cars.
I know nothing about it. Jeez, gosh.
My 7-year-old would have given the exact same, like, I got wheels, I got a steering.
I know, I'm like, oh gosh, what's another part? I don't know another part.
I don't, no gender for me. That's about all I know about cars as well. So thank you, EC. Thank you, everybody out there, for listening. Thank you for your ratings and your reviews. EC and I will be back next week for another episode of the Consistency Project Podcast.